Kane, Ms. Bartholomew?
That's correct, Judge. May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honor. I represent Savor Sutton, who is the petitioner in this matter. He is before the Court on an issue of whether or not his federal habeas petition is timely filed, and if it is not, if he is, in fact, eligible for equitable tolling. The whole case hinges on a factual determination involving a very short period of his procedural history. The decision of the Louisiana Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals on his direct appeal came back affirming his conviction and sentence on January 31, 1996. At that point, he was represented by the Louisiana Appellate Project. They withdrew from his case and elected not to file it in the Louisiana Supreme Court. Mr. Sutton, along with his co-defendant, Mr. Water, who's not involved in the case at this point in time, filed a joint application for writ of certiorari in the Louisiana Supreme Court on February 29, 1996. There's a 30-day window to file, so they are within the 30-day window to file. But here's what happens. Charlie Water is primarily responsible for putting together the filing for the Louisiana Supreme Court. He and Mr. Sutton are incarcerated in the same facility, initially in the Department of Corrections. They both submitted affidavits, which were included in our record excerpts for the court. The date is coming to file the case, and Charlie Water and Mr. Sutton are not physically in the same location in the Department of Corrections. Mr. Sutton is trying to get to a position where he can sign the filing. He is unable to do so. He is prevented from doing that by the Department of Corrections. So as not to delay the filing and miss their opportunity to file, Charlie Water signs it and files it with the Louisiana Supreme Court. Neither Charlie Water nor Mr. Sutton receive any notice that the Louisiana Supreme Court is not accepting the filing as to Mr. Sutton because it is not signed. The Louisiana Supreme Court then issues a decision on behalf of Charlie Water denying the writ application for not having any merit. Mr. Sutton becomes aware that there has been no decision issued for him when Charlie Water notifies him of the documents that he's received back from the Louisiana Supreme Court. Mr. Sutton then seeks assistance from an attorney who is licensed in the state of Georgia, who enters the case pro hoc vice here in the state of Louisiana, and files what they title a motion for out-of-time application for writ of certiorari in the Louisiana Supreme Court. There really is no vehicle for that in the Louisiana Supreme Court. They file that, and the Louisiana Supreme Court rules on June 4, 1999, motion to enroll as counsel and as counsel pro hoc vice granted, motion to file out-of-time petition for writ of certiorari denied on the showing made, even assuming that relator sought relief in number 96KO0551, that's the joint application with Mr. Water. Because that application lacked merit, see State v. Water, relator shows no grounds for relief. They never say that there's a jurisdictional or time problem with his filing. They simply say it lacks merit.
Well, what do you do with that motion to file out-of-time petition denied? I mean, once they denied it, and then it looked like on its face that they went ahead and even if we had granted the thing, but that's not a grant, is it?
Well, it's not a grant, and there is no real vehicle to do that in the Louisiana Supreme Court. They then reference back to the 96 application that was properly timely filed, minus the signature of Mr. Sutton, for which Mr. Sutton was never notified, which creates another issue in his case factually. And then they say, because there was no merit anyway. Denied on the showing made because there was no merit. They don't say denied because he's out of time. They say denied because there was no merit. So we're not going to grant it. There was no merit to start with. That's what their decision seems to say. It's very vague as to their reasoning. The question becomes, is that filing in the Louisiana Supreme Court timely? Because if it is, his application for federal habeas is timely because it was pending through the whole period of time. And there's no issue, it should be granted. If it is not timely and the finality of his conviction and sentence occurs following the decision of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is January 31st, 1996, then he is not timely and we have to consider the issue of equitable tolling because the state prevented him from being timely. And so there's the factual determination first that has to be made before we move into the legal issues involved if, in fact, it is not timely. Magistrate court and the district court determined it was not timely. That was their factual analysis. But this court can review that de novo and come up with a different factual determination. And we believe that based on case law out of this circuit previously, where this circuit has found in Molossin versus Kahlo and in Grillier versus the warden of Wynn Correctional Center, both collateral review cases, not direct appeal cases, where the court has interpreted vague decisions by Louisiana courts, such as the one in this case, as allowing for timely filings. So we believe that there is precedent in this case for interpreting this decision by the Louisiana Supreme Court, the denial on the merits, as a timely filing.
Let me take you to Berman, a tolling and pace. What in this record is going to support finding that observation that lack of diligence? You say that the president didn't allow them to. So what does the record show about that circumstance?
Both Mr. Water and Mr. Sutton submitted affidavits on behalf of Mr. Sutton listing forth the facts as they recalled them related to the filing in the Supreme Court. Now, I understand that Mr. Sutton's petition could be considered self-serving because this is his case. But Mr. Water has no reason whatsoever to support Mr. Sutton in this matter. His case is final, decided, and done. He is out of time to file anything. He gains no benefit from assisting Mr. Sutton providing the affidavit.
Where does the notion of filing this joint petition come from? I mean, what does that spring from?
The case in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals was consolidated. And I believe because they were filing pro se without the assistance of a lawyer, they understood that they needed to file it as a consolidated case, considering that their knowledge of the law is limited. They followed what had been done in the Fourth and applied it to their filing in the Supreme Court. That's how it gets filed as a consolidated case in the Supreme Court by Mr. Water and Mr. Sutton. On the equitable tolling issue, Mr. Sutton has to demonstrate that he pursued his claim diligently. As soon as he found out that there was a problem with his filing, and again, there's a lack of notice by the court that there's a problem with the filing. Mr. Water receives no notice. Mr. Sutton receives no notice.
Well, it was not curable at that point anyway by Mr. Sutton, was it?
It may have been curable at that point.
It's untimely.
If the court had allowed him to sign it, if they had notified him that it wasn't signed and had given him time to sign it, and the court can do that with those sorts of issues, but he wasn't notified about the timeliness issue, and so he wasn't able to pursue that.
Well, how could they cure that and then say that the petition that he later filed is not curable? How can you say that that was curable, but the later petition was not curable?
The original petition filed on the 29th is filed within the 30 days. The technical problem is the lack of Mr. Sutton's signature, not the lack of filing by the deadline. Had the court notified Mr. Sutton that the petition wasn't signed and they weren't going to grant it,
that's your
he
argument.
Could have addressed that.
I know that's your argument, but the argument about the other thing is that the Louisiana, as you keep saying, Louisiana has no procedure to correct the problem post hoc in the untimely petition that he did file, and I'm just asking you, is there a law that would have arguably allowed him to sign the other fellow's petition?
There's no rule per se, but the court, when there is a technical error, can allow you a few days to correct the technical error.
So you don't
and
have
they
a,
do that.
A case, you're just extrapolating.
From my experience with the court,
okay.
Yes. But the filing, then he doesn't receive his notice until much later that there's been a problem. So there's the initial filing in 96 is timely. There's the technical issue of the signature that occurs. And then that subsequent filing, for which there is no vehicle in Louisiana law, is in 99. So that is substantially later when he receives notice that there's been a problem because they received
when
the decision on Mr. Water case.
When did he learn that that he was not that petition was not denied as to him?
When the decision came down on Mr. Water case, that was in 99. There's a great delay that occurs in the decision coming out on the case, presumably because it's a pro se filing.
It was filed in 96?
It was filed in 96.
So it's 3 years after the joint one was filed, no signature, et cetera. So the next notice is the ruling in 99, is that right?
Is the ruling on Mr. Waters' case, yes. And then Mr. Sutton takes action to try to address what he now realizes is a problem with the filing in the Louisiana Supreme Court.
So did Mr. Waters actually receive like a copy of the ruling?
He received writ denied. It was simply writ denied in his manner.
But I mean, he got a piece of paper that
and
came.
And he forwarded it to Mr. Sutton. And it only had his name on it in terms of the denial. Mr. Sutton then attempts to figure out what's going on with the case and files, through an attorney, this motion to review his matter.
How long did he, how much time elapsed after he learned that he was not on the petition?
I'm going to have to look that question up, but I don't believe it was a lengthy period of time. I believe it was a short period of time from the decision to the filing by Mr. Sutton to get the case to consider his matter. Let's see.
Keep going to something else and you can pick it up.
That's fine, Judge. So on the equitable tolling issue, if the court decides that the magistrate and district court's determination is correct, that the filing is untimely because of the technical issues that occur between the Fourth Circuit direct appeal and the Supreme Court direct appeal, Mr. Sutton has to show that he pursued his claim diligently. Upon finding out, he does pursue his claim, and he continues to pursue his claims after that through his post-conviction process very diligently and largely pro se. And that there was an extraordinary circumstance that prevented him from filing timely. And in this case, I believe there is. He's prevented by the Department of Corrections from signing the filing that is prepared, which is what creates the problem in the first place. And then there is no notice received by himself or the other individual on the filing, Mr. Water, that there's a problem with the filing.
No. Okay, well, you know our equitable tolling cases. I mean, they're in a real narrow universe. And so what's the closest case you have that what transpired here with Department of Corrections constitutes, you know, what our cases have held as, you know, an obstruction by the other side, a prevention, something beyond defendant's control, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we haven't really said it's when somebody just didn't know or otherwise wasn't aware, but we've required a more palpable exercise to
there's actually a number of cases that would support the failure of notification by a court. Most recently, there's the United States Supreme Court decision in Maples versus Thomas, which deals with the fact that while the court sent notice to the individual's attorney, the attorney had moved.
Well, I mean, we know what Maples says, but you're reaching, you know, if you're going way to Maples too.
In this court's decision.
My question. I'm saying what's in this narrow universe of finding equitable tolling, given what we required. I'm saying what's the closest case within the circuit?
Williams versus Thaler, Fifth Circuit, November 2nd, 2010, in which the court failed to notify an inmate that his post-conviction application was denied and misinformed him that his application was still pending when, in fact, it had been denied. Equitable tolling.
Now, you say that the Department of Corrections prevented Mr. Sutton from signing the timely petition. Is that fleshed out factually at all?
That is in both his affidavit and Mr. Waters' affidavit, which were included in the record exhibits.
Well, what does prevent mean? Because I usually think that prevent means that the state was deliberately trying to keep the defendant from doing something or knowing something. And
according to the affidavit by Charlie Water, he states, the authorities would never let us sign together, and only my signature was obtained on the petition. They wouldn't let them together to sign the petition, and Mr. Water had the petition in his possession. I submitted it as I had to, like that no one ever informed me that this application was not accepted on behalf of both of us. Though that's his handwritten language in his affidavit.
Okay.
Mr. Sutton has similar comments in his affidavit, but I think Mr. Water, like I said, because he really has nothing to gain from supporting Mr. Sutton on this matter, as his case is completely final, is relevant. And I believe I'm at my time.
All right. You've reserved some rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Mr. Pickett?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I believe that most of my opposing counsel arguments are adequately addressed in the State's brief and the merits of this issue. I would just like to briefly address a few points that were made by counsel for Mr. Sutton regarding the time on this issue. And I have a few exhibits. These are already in the record. But just as far as the timeliness, after the Fourth Circuit affirmed the convictions of both Mr. Sutton and Mr. Water alone filed an application for a writ of certiorari from the Louisiana Supreme Court. And appropriately, only his name appears on the actual application. There's not even a space, a blank for Mr. Sutton, and he just failed the signature. It was only in his name. The Court noted and accepted it and decided it only in Mr. Water's name. Now, as far as the efforts that Mr. Sutton may have made to sign it, I respectfully disagree with my friend Ms. Bartholomew about whether, and I agree with her as far as Mr. Sutton, his affidavit is clearly self-serving, but that Mr. Water's affidavit is somehow not self-serving, and that those are the only two pieces of evidence that would affirm their efforts, or Mr. Sutton's efforts to sign the Louisiana Supreme Court writ application. Is certainly just as self-serving. I mean, he's not an
Speak
independent.
Speak up just a little bit. If you elevate your voice a bit for me.
Certainly, Mr. Chief Judge. Mr. Water's affidavit is just as self-serving. I mean, these are people who have been friends for a long time. They were co-defendants. They are partners in crime, literally. I clearly don't think that he is, free and standing apart from all this as an unbiased, objective declarant. But I think that's irrelevant anyway. Opposing counsel noted that, from what I heard, she said that the Louisiana Supreme Court ultimately denied Mr. Water's writ application on direct review in 1999, which is the same year that Mr. Waters then filed his motion for out of time. Relieve out of time. Actually, it was denied on June 7th, 1996. 3 years, almost 3 years, because it was February of 1999 that Mr. Waters finally got around to filing. And this really is the cream of my argument here, that this is a case.
But the record does show that when the ruling was ultimately issued, that he then diligently responded to that and wanted the. Went back to the court unsuccessfully. So, I mean, he obviously, when he did learn that he wasn't on it, and apparently from this record, that's the first time he would not have known that, he acted.
Well, certainly, and even before we get to that, I would argue that issue is irrelevant as far as what, Mr. Sutton is seeking.
Voice up! I can't hear you.
And I'm very sorry.
Just speak more loudly.
I'm always afraid of speaking too loud, as I normally do.
We'll tell you if
well,
you're
go
too
ahead
loud,
and speak
okay?
Too loud.
Just speak too loud. We'll tell you.
Certainly, Your Honor. The question of whether Mr. Sutton is prejudiced by, if you want to count as an impediment created by the state by Louisiana Supreme Court's failure to notify him that Mr. Waters' writ application had been denied. That's not a duty that was incumbent on the Louisiana Supreme Court because he was not a party to Mr. Waters' writ application. And you don't have a right to be notified of actions in unrelated cases. And this, as far as the Supreme Court was concerned, is unrelated. He didn't sign it. I mean, and also if you look, and this is, I think, what the case turns on, this is The real ruling this turns on is the Louisiana Supreme Court's denial of his motion for permission to file out of time. The language is very simple. It's straightforward. The only person who finds this vague is Mr. Sutton. His motion is very clear. Permission to file out of time petition for writ of certiorari. The Louisiana Supreme Court comes back and says quite clearly, as Judge Higginbotham pointed out, that the motion to file an out-of-time petition is denied. The Supreme Court is saying quite clearly, we are not going to allow you to even file out of time. We're not going, let alone consider the merits.
What did that request to file contain? What were the arguments?
It contains initially a brief summary of the procedural history. The second paragraph is his claim of the efforts he made, how he meant to file on time. So that is an argument that, well, I meant this to be timely, but it's not. Third, he brings up Kyles versus Whitley, which had been Kyles versus Whitley, Your Honor, which had been decided in the interim between his conviction and the Fourth Circuit's affirming opinions. So it's a procedural history, a procedural argument, and then a merits argument. The Louisiana Supreme Court denies on the showing made. Now, the case law is pretty clear
Did the court in any way consider the equitable tolling doctrine of any kind?
Did the Louisiana Supreme Court?
What I'm trying to get at is, did he make his equitable tolling argument to the Louisiana court?
He included, I believe, a single sentence in the end saying this would affect, you know, he did not, Your Honor. He told them that he had to exhaust his remedies for habeas. He did not mention to the Supreme Court anything about the.
So it was by definition untimely, and so the court had no alternative but to say it was just untimely because it was. Louisiana Supreme, you don't maintain the Louisiana Supreme Court also decided that it was untimely measured by anything other than just the lapse of time, that there was no equitable doctrine considered by them.
Certainly, Your Honor. They simply said, and the Louisiana Supreme Court rules are very clear, and this is a point of confusion in Mr. Sutton's brief.
Why shouldn't we conclude that on the record that we have, that the state did not allow him to sign the petition, and when he first learned that he wasn't being considered as being part of that, that he did act timely, and under those circumstances, that we, as a matter of equity, ought to toll it and let him at least reach the merits of his claim.
As far as just the equitable tolling beyond whether or not it's actually statutorily timely. You mean it's as far as equitable tolling beyond assuming that statutorily it's not timely, the equitable tolling argument alone? Or do you want me to address both? Quite clearly, I don't think that this is an impediment that even would rise under the controlling precedent that would rise to the level of some extraordinary circumstance. There's no, as Judge Jones pointed out, the idea of prevented through the actions of the state, that there had to be some.
Well, that's pretty strong. The state won't let him sign it. I mean, that's what happened.
And I believe that
you suggested maybe they made it up. I don't know, but the record and all the ones we've got is that these two people both swear by an affidavit that they weren't allowed to do that.
And I believe the district court, to the extent they consider that, made a determination that those affidavits were not credible.
What about the argument that was made to the court and with the filing by Mr. Waters? Was it an argument that was common to the claim of Sutton?
As far as the merits claim,
Were they making the same argument?
I don't believe the Whitley claim appears. Mr. Waters' brief or his writ application to the Supreme Court appears to be he just took the Fourth Circuit brief of his counsel
What was Waters' argument before?
Well, he raised to the Supreme. He raised 12 different assignments of error, actually.
What I'm trying to get at is whether the attack was a shared attack.
As far as the failure the merits.
Yes.
I believe he did raise. I mean, it was certainly related to one of the issues. I don't know if it was word for word the same, but it was a similar factual basis. But it was.
Well, let me ask you another way. Did the claim of Waters, if he had been granted relief on the legal theories, would Sutton also have been entitled to it had he been on the?
That is not easy to say because the legal basis was different because Mr. Sutton included a Supreme Court case that Mr. Waters did not include. It had not been decided by the time his actual arguments were put on paper.
If he had signed the brief, they both had signed the brief, would they both have been entitled to relief or not?
Well,
they would ride the outcome of the case together, one way or the other.
You would have to presume, based on the way they disposed Mr. Waters' application, that he would not have been entitled to relief. He found that the Supreme Court found Mr. Waters' claims to be without merit. They denied his writ application.
I'm sorry, I can't understand. You're dropping your voice.
Your Honor. The way I believe you.
I give up.
What you asked is if Mr. Sutton had timely joined Mr. Waters' writ application.
I'm just asking you, what we have here is that. The claim that one prisoner filed a petition, the other should have been allowed to join it. I'm going back to say, well, let's say he was allowed to join it. Would that claim have been common to both of them? That seems like a very basic question.
They're two different defendants. They were caught up in different ways by the police, as I understand it, after these two people got murdered, right?
Yes.
So what issues were they raising in common? That's what Judge Higginbotham is.
Well, I mean, you would have to assume that because they...
We're just asking a fact question.
The same claims, because the arguments raised in the timely Louisiana Supreme Court writ application filed by Waters were the same as they both raised in their joint appeal. So he would have joined in the same claims that Mr. Waters raised and presumably would have had relief denied.
Were they pro se in their joint appeal?
No. And while certainly it's somewhat of a speculative question, I think there's some certainty can be added by the fact that the district court, in looking at the equitable tolling argument, his actual innocence claim, reviewed the evidence that he submitted as far as, well, if had this happened, it would have been DNA testing of a black skull cap. Use of an undated receipt from the motel where they were staying. The district court reviewed this and said none of that would have caused the jury to have come to a
different verdict. So what happened to Waters' claim?
To Waters' claim on direct appeal?
Yeah.
It was denied.
Okay.
Denied all the way through to the Supreme Court, the Louisiana Supreme Court. I do not believe he filed for a writ of certiorari. However, I still think that what this case turns on, and as far as the equitable tolling argument, I just don't think that he's come close to who. It's an exacting standard, an exacting threshold, and he just hasn't come close to showing. I think his evidence, his proof of any impediment is very weak, and that's the state's.
Ms. Bartholomew, in responding to my question, cited me to Williams versus Taylor. I asked her what was her best case fitting the circumstance here within our equitable tolling doctrine. She says Williams v. Thaler. What do you say?
She mentioned Williams. She mentioned Maples. And as far as, I mean, I don't think there's any case really for, as far as Maples, that's...
But I didn't ask you about Maples. I mean, you gotta, we're not trying to be tough with you, but I don't know if it's nervousness, just... It's not difficult. Just try to respond to what we're asking. We know the state's position.
Certainly.
Denied. But we're just trying to get some help with what's in the papers. We're not trying to trick you. Just stay with the question, and it just helps us to understand what you already know. So all I'm asking you was about, I ask her, what's your best case that supports your theory of equitable tolling in this case? She started to tell me about Maples. I said, I want to know about Maples. Tell me the best for search. She said, "When I'm just trying to give you a fair opportunity to respond to her telling me that Williams is applicable." So I assume you would disagree, and I just want to hear you tell me why.
Well, to be honest, Your Honor, I'm not personally familiar with the Williams case. I remember scribbling down when she said the basis of what it involved.
Okay.
But if it is, in fact, I mean, if it's a situation where it's a collateral attack or a case where the issue was whether he's entitled to, you know, whether it's a procedural default issue, that it does not bear on the question under 2244 D1A of the finality or of the question of ethics.
Your argument is that whatever her argument is, these circumstances don't fit the extraordinary kind of circumstance that we normally require. Is that what you're arguing? That's your bottom line.
Sir, and that's certainly yes. That is exactly what the state is arguing, that an affidavit from two self-interested parties that, well, I tried to sign it, but I couldn't.
I mean, putting aside the affidavit part, I mean, the cutting part here is, you know, the no notice, the lack of notice. That's what's permeating her theory, that they didn't get notice, you know, and the only way he could have acted was to have gotten a notice, et cetera, et cetera. Forget about the affidavits of the two, but the state hadn't said, well, he did have notice, the state mailed it to him, yada, yada, yada. So we've got kind of a lack of notice. So the question is, and the briefs kind of get into it, well, whose duty is it, you know? And the petition would say, well, it's the state's duty, you know, to notify me. They don't notify me, therefore I can't act. If the state is the one who's not notified, then that's an extraordinary circumstance. That's the argument they're making about the notice provision. So what do you say about the notice? Was there some diligence you argued that he should have made that ameliorates it, or what?
Well, the state's argument simply is that in the eyes of the Louisiana Supreme Court, Mr. Sutton was never a party to Mr. Waters' writ application, and therefore it had no duty to give him notice of a case that didn't involve him, that didn't affect his rights. This is only the case all along the Louisiana Supreme Court, from the time it got to the clerk's office, was State versus Water. It was never involving Mr. Forrest Sutton. And I think something that is probative is that there's not even Mr. Sutton's name is not even on the application with a blank line that he just somehow didn't make it in time to sign. Mr. Waters didn't even include Mr. Sutton's name, even typewritten, anywhere on it.
Well, after he filed his motion for an out-of-time appeal, and that's denied, that relates to Mr. Sutton, right?
That's because that was Mr. Sutton's motion.
Is there anything in the scenario from that denial that put a duty on the part of the state to notify him?
From the denial of his motion?
Yeah. He's asking for out-of-time appeal based on all that has transpired. So, I mean, that relates to him. And, again, I guess I'm understanding the state's view. There is no extraordinary circumstance here, period. Right? Is that what you're arguing?
Certainly, Your Honor. Okay. And because the only thing that I would argue or that I could concede comes close is the notice from the initial appeal, but as I've argued, Mr. Sutton was never a party to that writ application. Therefore, the state Supreme Court had no notice to send. It had as much duty to send notice to Mr. Sutton as it did to you or I, because we were not parties to that case. As far as this, I mean, his motion for out of time to file a writ application, the Supreme Court's action is very clear. It said denied, and even if he were to have, and I think where it is a clear procedural denial, because it said even if Mr. Sutton had joined in Mr. Waters' timely writ application. Ergo, even if Mr. Sutton had timely filed his claims, we would find them to be without merit. And that's a caveat. That's merely a secondary reason. And the Supreme Court and this circuit have held that, you know, and as they did, and I've always feared having an oral argument, having to deal with Grillet, because I don't know if it's Grillet or Griet. Hmm. But and
only in Louisiana would it be Griet.
Daubert, Daubert. I mean, it happens with many cases. That where you have a facially unambiguous ruling that this is not timely or some way procedurally defaulted, any subsequent alternative discussion of the merits, especially, he says, even if, that's conditional. That does not suffice to make it on the merits. And I think because if you look at the very nomenclature, a motion for permission to file out-of-time petition, which was denied, means we are not allowing you to even file the out-of-time petition. And even if you had timely filed with Mr. Water, you would find it to be without merit. It makes it very clear on its face that the Louisiana Supreme Court is saying this is not timely filed. We are not even going to let you file this, let alone consider it. The Supreme Court never reached the merits of the claim. Never. They said we're not allowing you to even present the merits of your claim to us, is what they said, because they're denying the motion. They didn't grant the motion to deny relief. They said we're denying your motion for leave to file out of time. Goodbye. That is what they said. There's no way that this is a ruling on the merits. This did not, under Jimenez, serve to revive or reopen his avenue of direct appeal. especially since the Louisiana Supreme Court's own rules are very clear, unlike, and I believe the confusion is in the, his brief, Mr. Sutton cited to Louisiana Supreme Court Rule 4.3, which was the subject of Griette slash Grillette and Melanson. Well, that is a Louisiana Fourth Circuit, or that's Uniform Courts of Appeal, that explicitly allows for out-of-time filing beyond the 30-day deadline if certain conditions are met. The last word, the last sentence, rather, of the Louisiana Supreme Court's rule on timely file says no exception of time shall be, or no extension of time shall be permitted, therefore. None beyond the 30 days. So this is not a case where Melanson, I see my time is also up, if I may just briefly finish my thought and field any questions you may have. Melanson and Griette are inapplicable because they deal with a situation that is not present when you're dealing with the Louisiana Supreme Court. Jimenez does not apply. This is clearly a ruling on the procedure, the procedural aspect, and I believe that the rest, anything else I would say, is adequately covered in the brief. If there are no further questions from the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
On the issue of equitable tolling, I have additional case law for you. Critchley versus Thaler, 586 F3D 318, Fifth Circuit, 2009. Equitable tolling granted where the court clerk failed to file petitioner's post-conviction application even all though it was mailed.
All those you're about to cite, are they in your brief?
They are in the brief.
All right, well, yeah, just want to be clear. Keep
yes.
going.
Well, they are mailed to the clerk for filing. Holland versus Florida, which is not in my brief, it's in the state's brief. 130 Supreme Court, 2549, 2010, there is a rebuttable presumption in favor of equitable tolling, reversed in favor of petitioner, where the petitioner's attorney failed to provide him with the notice of final decision. Funk versus Thaler, Fifth Circuit, August 13th, 2010. Mr. Funk raised issues of equitable tolling and actual innocence in his certificate of appealability for dismissal of his 2254 petition as untimely held. The right. district court let erred in
stop.
Not.
Let me stop you and ask you a question to make sure I'm understanding. Maybe I misunderstood what you said in terms of dates, but as I understand it, the Louisiana Supreme Court denied the unsigned joint petition in 96.
That's correct. I went back and looked through my brief, and that is correct.
So it's 1999 when your client filed his motion. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right. So what are we supposed to do with this 3 years between the time that the Supreme Court rendered a ruling and the time that he actually filed something?
It's my position that his case is still pending during that period of time based on the language of the ruling that comes down in 1999 from the Louisiana Supreme Court.
What do you mean
court.
By that?
The fact that they have denied the procedural application that occurs in 99 because there is no procedure for that. But they then
they denied
say
the only petition they had, which was one signed by Waters.
But then they say, even assuming that relator sought relief in number 96, KO0551, that's the joint application. Because that application lacked merit, relator shows no grounds for relief. It's my position they're saying that the reason they're not granting this out-of-time request is because the 96 petition shows no grounds for relief. It lacked merit. There's no grounds, and so they're not going to entertain anything. Even assuming that relator sought relief in 96, they're not saying that he didn't. They're operating under the assumption that, in fact, he did. They're just not going to hear it because it didn't have any merit in the first place.
And that's after they say that the untimely motion is denied, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And so, as I was saying, Funk versus Thaler held the district court erred in not holding a hearing to determine if there is a state-created impediment. And I believe there is enough factual distinction put forth in this case that at a very minimum, a hearing should have been held on this issue.
A hearing for what?
As to whether or not there is, in fact, a state-created impediment. Before we're going to deny the equitable tolling issue, there is a factual basis to have a hearing to determine.
All right, articulate for us what you say this court ought to hold that the impediment is in this equitable tolling context?
The impediment is the Department of Corrections preventing Mr. Sutton from signing the application and getting it filed in the Louisiana Supreme Court, impediment number one. Impediment number two is the lack of notification from the Supreme Court that there's a problem with the filing. There's two impediments, but the first one is most definitely the Department of Corrections.
Well, how did they impede him from signing it? The blank counsel opposite shows it only shows one line for one person to sign.
Again, the affidavits submitted by Mr. Water and Mr. Sutton in 99 to the Louisiana Supreme Court, they're dated in 99, indicate that he was prevented from signing. I believe they present enough of a factual question in this case to have a hearing for them to come in and testify and present whatever evidence there may be in the forms of testimony and explanation as to what happened.
Okay. Wouldn't be rocket science to figure out what they would say. It just wouldn't be. So, I don't know how far you're going to get on affidavits. I'm just trying to get back to, you got a form. I understood your argument first was, they filed together. These cases are consolidated, but the form is one line for one person. So,
because Mr. Water explains, Mr. Sutton wasn't able to sign it, and he didn't want to not timely file.
I've never, and it's not germane, maybe it's just my curious mind, I've still never understood how Mr. Sutton fathom that something prohibited him having his own form with his own name on it, and they both are filed. The worst that would happen is the two would be consolidated as the cases were. Since the form doesn't have two lines and it's not been argued that somebody told him they could file. It's not blame the victim, but just trying to trace it through, you're trying to shake this impediment when the initial document, you haven't argued that the state misled, for example, them into believing that they could file a joint one, find out that's wrong, gotcha, you're out of there. Then I might be following, okay, the state somehow did that. But nothing in the papers I've read have said the state, the prison, anybody, is what sows the seed of wanting two people to sign a sheet of paper. So if file one, it's 3 years it gets back, and then you pick up with, the state, it's the obstruction in the lack of notification on the back end. And I've just found it hard to square that with the other cases that we have and even those that have been cited. I'm not arguing with you about it, but it just seems like you're putting a lot of stake in these two affidavits and what they say. And that's why I said, what in the world would a hearing, produce?
May I respond?
Yes.
I'm out of time. Thank you.
Probably wasn't a question there, but go ahead.
It seems to me that your concern is why did they feel that they had to file a joint application as opposed to separate applications. And as a lawyer and a jurist, I understand that question.
Understand. I'm not really trying to get in his head about it, but it just seems a lot of your argument is taken off from the point of what happens when the joint one, he doesn't sign it and there's no relief. And squaring that with some kind of due diligence and diligence on the part when no allegation has been made that some state actor, somebody in the prison, somehow caused that reliance to his detriment, then ergo it's a gotcha, it's not found. You don't pick up with the state until it's later saying, it's this period of time, the non-notice part, et cetera. And I'm just sort of wondering out loud in the equation of things, since we're talking about, but I hear you. You say read the affidavits, we read them.
Thank you. Anything else that I can assist the court with today?
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Both counsel, the case will be submitted. This will conclude the arguments for today. This panel will stand and recess.